I'd like to introduce Jonathan Zittrain, who is one of the co-founders of the Berkman Center, and now with the Oxford Internet Institute. Jonathan, you want to take over?
Well, good afternoon. Is this too loud? Was that a yes? No, it was not too loud. All right, when the feedback happens, you'll regret it. So, my name is Jonathan Zittrain. I teach internet law at Oxford and here at HLS. And it's my honor to moderate our last panel of our plenary and other gatherings here in Ames for the past 2 days. Our topic is code and law, but by some necessity, I think we'll be trying to wrap up and capture some of the themes that have emerged over this time. Our hope in doing so is, given it's our last panel and that there's such a brain trust in the room, is not to have rather lengthy presentations from our panelists, but actually very brief opening remarks. And the way I'd like to fashion it is by asking each of our guests to pose what they see as one of the most profound, deep, interesting problems in this space, either that got highlighted over the last day or two, or maybe even more interestingly, that did not. And they optionally may take a crack at trying to answer it themselves, and we can see what comes out of that. I will also try to pay particular attention to the question machine up there, and if I seem to not be doing that, please start pointing at it, and I will get the cue, and we'll see what is in the cue. So let us begin with Ira Rubenstein. Ira, first just tell us who you are and what path brought you to the chair you're sitting in right now.
I'm an attorney at Microsoft, and I indicated yesterday that I do regulatory compliance for product development around privacy and security, and have long been interested in identity issues.
And how long have you been at Microsoft?
Since 1990.
And what did you do before that?
I was in private practice.
Gotcha. 1990. That was basically Windows 3.1 was all the rage when you came in.
That's exactly right.
Lotus 1-2-3 had 90% market share for spreadsheets. But that changed. So tell us, what do you see as one of the biggest problems in the space? And I'm going to take notes on the screen behind you as you speak.
Okay. I'm going to describe a problem that I wouldn't say is profound, but I think it's important because it's maybe too easily forgotten in this group given the level of expertise and knowledge in the room. It comes back to some themes that have been echoed throughout the conference, which have to do with the contributions of a user-centric identity model to privacy. Again and again, we've heard user consent, multiplicity of operators, contextualized-based identity, a great deal of agreement around those principles among a wide swath of companies on the commercial side, the open source side. And I said a little bit of this yesterday, but I don't want us to forget that this is a rare moment in the tech industry where you have that kind of consensus among these companies. They're all designing technology with privacy in mind.
So Ira, let me just ask real quick.
I'll get to the question.
Exactly. I don't mean to put jeopardy on you, but I don't hear the form of a question yet.
Okay. Yeah. Well, one more sentence and then okay. I'll get to the question. And the final sentence is, when I spoke about this yesterday, Mark Rotenberg said, that's what we told you when you shipped Passport. That's exactly the point. That is what they told us when we shipped Passport. That was 5 years ago. We didn't have these conferences 5 years ago. We didn't have this level of consensus 5 years ago. So my question is really very straightforward, which is that not all governments are enlightened, and governments are going to bring the most pressure to conceptualize identity in a fashion that requires very strong identity, a great deal of disclosure of personal information, and even as we've seen in the case of the UK identity card, a bias in favor of a one-size-fits-all, all-purpose identity card. So I think one of the key tasks, maybe not a problem, but a key task of a group like this would be, how do we ensure that that's not the future of identity? Because lurking in the background around a lot of the concerns or even fears that have been expressed about identity is that sort of model. So what can we do? So my question is really practical. What can we do as a group to help ensure that that's not the future of identity, that you don't get any kind of identity creep between the types of highly contextualized approaches to identity that have been discussed today, with or without, you know, various shortcomings, but how do you keep that from being swamped by this much more, limited and negative approach that might otherwise occur if people such as ourselves who are enlightened about these issues are not, you know, vocal and quite persuasive in dealing with this other trend as it arises in the government or e-government sector.
And the connection with overseas governments of some kinds is that they may compel or force some kind of bleed between these spaces.
Right. I think either because they're approaching this in terms of border crossings and passports, or applying for, you know, benefits from a government where fraud is a concern, they're going to be much more inclined to demand stronger identity and disclosure of more personal information to, you know, ensure their own interests.
And do you have any thoughts on answering that question, if we've in fact got it right?
Well, I guess the only thought I have at this point, and I came to this conference having spent a fair amount of time preparing a draft white paper that's not quite ready for prime time, but the focus of the white paper is how the laws of identity, as described by Kim Cameron, strongly support or match extremely well the basic principles of the data protection directive in Europe. I think the next phase, though, is to really go a step further and to ask, are there issues that are not currently addressed by privacy law that arise in this identity management context? And if so, to what extent does the technology address that? And if the technology either doesn't address it sufficiently or leaves gaps, then what specific changes in legal regimes are needed? I think we've kind of circled around these issues, but I think that's a very concrete task that could be taken on. And if, you know, additional thought and papers and presentations, et cetera, were developed with that in mind, that would be the basis for then having an agenda to promote with governments as they go into the e-government space using this technology.
Yeah. So can I ask on that question, as we understand it, for reaction, either from fellow panelists who know that their turn is coming up, or from anybody here, do we understand this question and the dimension of it? And yes. And I don't know if we need to race a mic over to you, or there we are. And I know this is odd given the conference, but feel free to tell us who you are.
My name is Tom Barrett from Encirca. I'm an ICANN accredited domain name registrar. And privacy is a big issue when it comes to domain names and who is. And in that example, the U.S. is actually behind other parts of the world related to privacy. So I'm challenging the premise that the U.S. is in good shape when we look at...
That wasn't my premise.
I've taken some liberties with Ira's words, too, so... Yeah.
I didn't say that.
So go ahead.
No, I mean, I didn't mean to imply that we had no work to do in the U.S. I did just give the example of the U.K. because of an early bad start and some work I'm familiar with at the London School of Economics critiquing the British approach to a national ID card. But that's only because the U.S. is incapable of taking on directly the whole question of national ID cards.
What do we need to do in the U.S. in particular to counteract the perceived interests of law enforcement and IP, intellectual property, that seem to encroach and perhaps conflict with the goal of privacy here.
I think a great deal is, I think a great deal of the principles that are needed have already been articulated in fair information practices, and I think, again, the task is to see where they may be deficient, and the main question in my mind is once information is, a lot of the technologies that we've been discussing have the, in my mind, very desirable characteristic of limiting the disclosure of information in a variety of ways. But nonetheless, some information is disclosed. And I think the key question to raise is what are the rules and therefore what are the sanctions and enforcement methods that govern that information once it's disclosed, and in particular that would govern any further disclosure for other uses.
One last question just before turning to our next panelist. Do you have any concern that if we arrive at an industry-wide cross-platform open standards kind of consensus such that we can develop technologies that start making identity really able to happen, but in the ways that are protective of privacy, is it possible that certain governments could simply take that system and just tweak something in it such that most of the work of building this massive identity management system is done, but they can basically just pull the plug on the protections that might be embedded within it? Maybe that's just a restatement of your question.
I don't think so. Going back to what Paul said in the earlier panel, I mean, there's a tendency to view ID systems as the equivalent of, you know, these context-free identifiers. But I think if you build a technology with specific contexts, you know, very much front and center, it's not going to be that easy to just make a tweak. And the more likely, I think in some sense, the more realistic fear is that governments will see that, and in response to that, they may react adversely. But that would require the full political process. That would require enacting laws that specifically mandate a different identity model. And I think that's a tougher challenge than if just a simple tweak of the code accomplished the same end.
Okay. So let us turn now to John Bliss, who is here from IBM, but not for long. I understand that it won't be that anybody offends him, but that in about 15 minutes he'll leave the room to catch a plane. So John, tell us who you are and how you got here.
I too am a lawyer, but happily I'm in remission, according to my father. I got here by cabin, by plane, but actually by an acquisition of a small company called Systems Research and Development. We were acquired by IBM in January of 2005. We do a lot of identity analytics, principally for government agencies, Homeland Security, Intel, banks, and such. The question that I think about a lot is, you know, to state the obvious, we are awash in a world of information, but we're bereft of knowledge. And the challenge is how to convert that information into knowledge and how to do so in a privacy-enhancing way. That's what we spend a lot of time thinking about.
And do you have a specific example in mind for that?
I may.
Let's hear it.
So I was asked to talk about the possible application of one of our technologies, which is an anonymization technology. It basically takes the clear text technologies which we have, which is essentially, who? Is John Bliss the same as John S. Bliss, the same as at this residence address or at this P.O. box, this phone number? And once it's resolved that entity, it figures out who that person is related to. That's the relationship resolution technology. The third technology that we have developed and is commercialized is the capability of doing both those things in the encrypted space by using one-way hashes that are salted. And the issue was whether or not the application of that anonymization technology could be applied to some beneficial effect in the context of this current squabble we have with the European Union and the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Authority over whether we as a government are entitled to receive the European Airlines passenger name record information, which is some set of like 34 data fields of identity attributes. I think the short answer is that a properly managed and marshaled program using hashing, using salted hashing, whereby you would hash the PNR information at the airlines, hash the watch list data held by CBP, and then run those hash data sets in an anonymous entity repository, producing a match, where only the result would be a pointer back to the source system, the U.S. government saying, hey, there's a match against incoming passenger on European flight 12. His name is Mohammed Atta, and it matches a terrorist watch list person by the same name. I'm dramatically simplifying this because you're not just using names because you would produce an incredible number of false positives. Hopefully you'd have more information. But as a matter of law, it turns out that there is an escape valve that would be usable by the European authorities to anonymize the data under the European Data Protection Directive. Personal data, once hashed, ceases to be personal data, so it ceases to be subject to the restrictions on cross-border data transfers and so on under the law. This has some interesting privacy benefits. Right now, under the undertaking between the CBP and the EU, there are three pulls permitted against that data before the person flies and then 15 minutes after. To the extent you're able to anonymize the data, there may be some benefits in providing a little bit richer analysis against those entities that are about to board the plane and fly into the United States that would have the effect of reducing some of the false positives. So technically, it's probably less a privacy benefit than it is a civil liberties benefit in that you wouldn't be improperly detaining people. But I see that as one of the benefits. The Article 29 Working Party, which is the domain expert on privacy in the EU, identified some problems they had with the current sharing arrangement, one of which was proportionality, meaning too much data was going across the transom. Well, if you anonymize both data stores, the only data that would be flowing into the United States government would be that which related to a known bad guy. So you've addressed the proportionality concern of the Article 29 party. The other question was data quality. And to the extent that you can do more rigorous identity analytics in the encrypted space, you ratchet up the data quality of the PNR data that's being transferred. And the third was limited purpose. And I think that, as I just mentioned, if you're only matching on bad guys, you are extremely limiting the purpose of the data and the amount of the data. And last thing, and then I literally have to run and catch a plane, I'm sorry, I'm going to post a brief on the site and some PowerPoint slides and maybe even a demo. If there are questions, feel free to email me. I'm jblisslv@us.ibm.com. I just lost my thought. The last thing about limited purpose is it so happens that to avoid a certain cryptographic attack known as a dictionary attack, you need to salt the one-way hash values. An incidental benefit of that salting is both sides have to share the same salt values. And in doing so, you're limiting the repurposing of the data. So no longer is there a risk that it could be used to catch Debbie Dads. And with that,
so John, you actually have 5 minutes. Let me just use it to ask you a question.
Okay, I have to walk to Baker House.
You find it.
Go.
So here's the question. The problem with salted hashes just scrolled off the screen, but what it was saying who gets to determine what the salt is and
the sharing parties.
Who's to say that the receiving end party says, yeah, no, we don't necessarily want to share our watch list. That's ours, and we're a government.
This is the nub of the problem.
And you airlines, you know, we don't know what we might want. Yeah. So we want the whole thing, so we might repurpose it.
Problem is that you're never going to get the U.S. government to invest its prized jewels, its watch list, into probably a trusted third party that would be acceptable to the European Union.
Okay.
So political issue one is that first of all, they're going to have the trusted third party probably reside in the U.S. government and not be the watch list holder. So it'd be some other entity in the U.S. government. But the other issue,
like the National Archives or the
I don't know.
National Parks.
These are policy questions that have to be decided but yet aren't baked into the technology. I'm just suggesting a technology that would have to be wrapped in to a significant amount of policy decisions. One of the other things I think is a key concern would be, well, what happens post-match? So you've got an anonymized match. You know it's a bad guy. Who gets to see that data and what happens? And how do we make sure that that isn't repurposed?
Gotcha.
That would be another one that I worry about. So I don't want to suggest this is a panacea. I want to stimulate some discussion because I think legally it solves some problems. Technically, it solves some problems. But it also presents some problems that need to be addressed by smart people such as we have assembled here.
Yeah. John, thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm really sorry I have to run.
So it seems only logical now to turn to Jeremy Warren. Jeremy, tell us who you are.
I'm Jeremy Warren. Or at least so I think, for those of you who were here yesterday. I work at the U.S. Department of Justice. I am the Deputy Chief Technology Officer at the department, and we work in the Office of the Chief Information Officer on the IT side. So it's the responsibility of the Chief Technology Officer and our group to take a look at technologies that impact the department today and in the future, both in terms of the way that we run our business, in terms of the way that we interact with our partners, and in terms of its effect on our ability to do our jobs, meaning if it's part of the environment, how does it affect our law enforcement function? What will we have to do to deal with that?
Gotcha. So let me ask you a question before giving you a chance to ask a question, based a little bit on the question submitted there, which is, if you were called in for a consultation with the Attorney General of the United States, and he says, Jeremy, I understand you know all about this identity crap. We see a lot of movement in industry consensus such that the way people will identify themselves or their attributes to one another in daily life will no longer be through the production of a government state-issued driver's license or national ID card, but in fact may be through some kind of trusted web meta system coming from somewhere else. Is this going to be a long-term problem for law enforcement, or is this a good thing?
Well, both, and not for the same reason, of course. I think that the critical issue that we would have in the Department of Justice in terms of law enforcement would be traceability of identity information.
Which is to say, being able to connect up attributes to a person when you have to.
Yes, when you have to. And so I think that the state in general has the authority in certain situations to be able to, whether it's to prevent terrorism or whether it's to, you know, try to deal with with more petty crimes or to or even civil situations, to be able to get down to the truth of attribution of various kinds of actions. And so the balancing of the state's right, which is, you know, really the people's right to have those kinds of actions happen, the state's authority to do that, I would worry about the ability to have the proper traceability for attribution.
Yeah. So if I'm the AG, that sounds like a generic worry I ought to have. I completely agree with you. And I'm trying to square that with Ira's worry that people like me, without yet understanding whether I'm a good AG or a bad AG, are going to want to have that emergency lever to get traceability when we want it.
Well, I think that the key issue is going to be to divine a way so that it's not just that emergency lever that all of a sudden turns it from a very safe and secure system and a privacy-enhancing system to a system that is now enabling totalitarian kinds of authority. And there are lots of ways that I think that are interesting to try to do that.
I've got room for about three on the slide.
I think that diffusion of the information needed for traceability is one important factor. So that if it's not all in one place, then you can't just throw one little switch to make that happen. Diffusion of that information means that, and actually this is an idea that Kim yesterday talked about a little bit, that it requires you to have more people involved in the transaction of tracing it. So that more people are required to participate in saying, yes, the proper processes are being followed.
So this is the benefit, say, in today's version 1.0 ID world of having to kick in the door of multiple internet service providers in order to track somebody who threatened the president. You could still do it as long as you coordinate but it's not just flicking a switch.
Right. It shouldn't just be sitting in some government basement someplace with, you know, trusted people not, you know, connecting wire A to wire B and until, you know, crisis hits. It should be using various parts of, you know, of our society and various diffuse mechanisms to make sure that it does require a little bit more compliance with proper policy. Now, that's not always a complete bulwark against, you know, against policy violations, as may or may not be the case today, but I think it's a big help.
Yeah, would it worry you if the parties concerned in that diffuse space were routinely parties that were located overseas?
I think that would be a real problem, potentially.
So by diffuse, we mean Wyoming and California.
Well, at least diffuse in such a way that it would still be possible to put them back together. I think that the crossing of jurisdictions, that being able to use the technology to cross jurisdictions where it would require international cooperation in order to achieve that traceability is going to be a very big challenge.
So the diffusion point is great. Are there other big principles aside from diffusion that you'd put in?
I think that that anonymization that was talked about before is something that will help tremendously, because I truly believe that there are solutions that will help enhance privacy and not necessarily cut back on the government's authority to be able to access information, particular identity information. I think that we've been really sloppy and clumsy about this because of the kinds of tools that we've had available to us, that we see it as the government's authority and the public's privacy need as being solid objects with smooth surfaces between them where they have to push to one place or another. And I don't think that's the truth, because I think that for the most part, the government's need, and DOJ in particular's need to get access to identity information is very much long-tailed, that there are very, very few people to which the government needs to get access to the kinds of personally identifiable information that most people consider invading of their privacy. There are more people for whom it would be helpful to be able to use techniques like John had mentioned before with anonymization to get access to information that wouldn't necessarily be seen as being violating privacy. And for a great number of people, there may not be a tremendous need to get access to that information at all. So I think that you can devise systems where the government would be able to get access when appropriate to deep identity type information in just a very small percentage of cases, and where the vast majority of the population would never have to have their personally identifiable information being touched with these broad brushes. And so I think that's the solution, is to get to much more surgical kind of access to information and this proportionality concept, where you're only getting access to that information that would violate someone's privacy for those people for whom it's appropriate to violate their privacy.
Last question before I open it up, which is, I'm the AG, and I've heard a lot from these Poindexter types, I mean that quite literally, who tell me that data mining is all the rage.
In fact, in the DOJ, you know, we're the tech weenies who are the Poindexter types.
I'm thinking convicted felon Poindexter. reversed on appeal. On a technicality. Poindexter says, data mining is all the rage. And to do good data mining, you have to clear your mind of preconceptions about what links to what. We know that if we make an interesting database of people and attributes, and they all get a card and they all start relating to each other in different ways, whether it's by affirmatively giving each other proxies or just by the behavior in which they engage, by who they email, from whom they receive telephone calls, and all that, at some point we can come up with a systemic, emergent set of flags that then humans can use to do the kind of follow-up checking that we might want to do. And to do all of that may require violation of this principle of surgical access, where you say generally we have a blanket of functional anonymity, which may be pseudonymity, among the rank and file, but when you need to, you can penetrate the veil in an isolated surgical place. The data mining people, suppose they say to you, well, actually, it'd be great if at least a computer could see the whole thing, and we promise not to look at what the computer's looking at until out the out box it spits, hey, look out for this guy. We can't even say why, but the statistics say this guy is trouble?
Well, I hope that that's not the case. I hope that I have real promise, I think, in real faith in the promise of the anonymization technologies and making that not be the case.
Uh-huh.
Another thing is, as an interesting side point, the TIA program of which you speak actually had, to my knowledge, a lot of plans for protection built in around anonymization and controlled access and a lot more surgical type access than might otherwise have been the case. But that's a separate point. I guess the issue here is more around whether or not you would have to provide this kind of clear information to this massive data mining system and say, go at it and tell me what you can find.
Right.
I haven't come across situations where that kind of approach really has a lot of value.
Gotcha.
Or a lot of promise, I should say. Everything that I've seen in terms of data mining and technologies for data mining, and there may be a lot of new stuff out there that I haven't seen yet in the research labs, really requires modeling to be driving the kind of data mining that you're doing. It requires you to have some kind of idea of what it is that you're looking for.
Gotcha.
And so the hope is that at least the modeling that goes into what is it that you're looking for helps cut down the kind of information that you need to take a look at. And I also think makes it more likely that the anonymization technologies are going to work, because it's not a give the supercomputer everything that it might, all truth.
Yes.
Give it all truth, or at least all reported truth, and let it go and see what it finds. I don't see that as being something in the near term.
Reactions from our panel to Jeremy's question and issue? Or from people at large? Yes, Dave Weitzel.
So I spend a lot of time working on supporting government technology, and one of the things I see, we can have all of these how should the future be debates, but when I see DOD has already issued 3 to 4 million CAT cards, the United States government right now, every executive agency is in the middle of implementing HSPD-12 to give next generation smart cards to all of its employees. Real ID Act has passed, and it's being implemented through regulations that the Department of Homeland Security is in the process of promulgating. Isn't there a really big horse out of the barn here? And at some level, we might just be kidding ourselves on our own internal control, because I can see these smart cards linking into databases that already exist, and the chances of you getting any level of anonymity back may be slim to none.
Yeah.
Hate to be a bit dystopian here, but I'd at least like to be that be part of the debate today.
Well, that sounds like a question basically headed in Ira's direction, because it gets back to your premise that actually government in many zones, in our zone, has kind of held back and let industry come up with this consensus that has embedded a lot of the sort of worries, embedded in a good way, ways of addressing the worries of a few years ago.
I don't think I'd go that far. I mean, I think that you make a very good point, but if you look at the context in which some of these laws were passed, particularly the Real ID Act, the forethought that went into that was virtually non-existent. There's no question about that, and I think some of the consequences will soon be catching up, not only on the issues that we're discussing, but just on the even simpler issues of how states lacking, funding, personnel, and resources, much less, wisdom on this issue, are going to comply with these federal mandates. So there's undoubtedly a great deal of, a great extent of problems already out there. That makes the challenge harder, but I don't know that it changes the basic point that I was trying to make, which is that even in dealing with something like that, which to some extent, given the elevated level of conversation at this conference, would come across as a fairly, simple problem, just in the sense that the Real ID Act is so deficient, and we'd all recognize it as such, that we almost don't pay attention to it. But that's exactly what we have to pay attention to. I think that's where we have to begin, is in rectifying some of the shortcomings of existing legislation, existing technology rollouts.
So are you predicting that sometime this fall, Congressman Setzenbrenner is going to see the light, say that there wasn't a national debate that was engaged here?
I'm not a fool. No, I'm not particularly that.
Yes, one quick point, if I could, because you mentioned the CAT cards in DOD and HSPD-12, which, for those who may not know, it's Homeland Security Presidential Directive number 12. It requires all of the U.S. government agencies to have standardized processes for the identification and vetting of their employees and contractors in the real world, and then to move to standardized personal identity verification cards, you know, essentially smart cards, PKI-enabled, passive RF-enabled, that would be used for physical access to buildings and eventually for logical access to equipment. I think that's a completely different kind of issue than the real ID issue, because for military members and for federal employees and contractors, there is consent to this. I mean, we're employees of the government. We want to be able to go and work at the government. Whenever we walk into the building, we are, you know, we're giving our identity information to them. It's part of the transaction of working for the government and doing our jobs that I think is an appropriate application of this. The Real ID Act, I can't really speak intelligently about, but I think the HSPD-12 and the CAT cards should be kept out of that discussion.
Gotcha. Why don't we'll take one more question back there and then move on?
I think that was a good point.
Do we know who you are?
You look at and you see a distinction between the citizen and his role and an officer of the government. And officers are by nature limited in what they can do. They have terms, they have term limits, and therefore they have to follow sets of rules that are based on the fact that there are recognized problems when they cross over in their roles and assume roles that are inappropriate. But citizens, on the other hand, have no such restrictions. And I think one of the focuses of this is, are we going to be getting into a dystopian environment where we are being identified in particular roles as citizens and therefore would be limited in acts such that we should be engaging in, such as free speech, publication, and so on and so forth?
Identified as citizens, you mean when we undertake activities in our capacity as a citizen, like showing up at a protest, will it be too easy for us to be ID'd? Is that what I gather your...
Whatever. Yeah.
Whatever it might be.
In a role as a citizen.
Yeah.
Driver.
Yeah. And I don't know if anybody wants to take that on, or simply to have that as a perfectly good worry that's hard to plan for. I don't know. Is it on this subject? Yep.
My name is Ijovi Nueri, and not so much a question, but I wanted to share my experience with Japan's national ID system. A few years ago, I was hired by the governor of Nagano to audit JukiNet, which is Japan's deployment of the national ID system. And there were a couple of concerns that came up. One was that the federal government sort of implemented this and the local governments had no way of actually planning to deploy it. And so there was a lot of animosity between the local governments and the national government. During my test, I was able to basically compromise the local deployments of the national ID system. So I was able to create new citizens within the government. I was able to steal identities of citizens. And what's happened a lot recently in Japan is that now federal employees are actually stealing IDs by basically copying and creating DVDs of members in their community or local prefecture and selling that to organized crime.
Gives a new meaning to Blockbuster, right? What DVDs do you want tonight?
Exactly, right. Exactly. So I just wanted to share not so much my concern, but my real experience with national ID systems.
But now, is this system maybe sounds like it shares very little in common with the kinds of systems that have been talked about with such optimism, or at least in such detail here, right? This is a nationally mandated system that doesn't necessarily build in the kind of disaggregation of attributes that...
Well, it sounds a lot like the Real ID system. I mean, the basic idea behind JukiNet was to have one ID system or one system that you can aggregate all of your personal information to, so the bank can go to one authority and verify who you are as opposed to contacting multiple different government authorities.
Yeah. I don't know. Does anybody have experience that could correlate with the Japan experience shared here? Not yet.
Is your group well acquainted with and expert on this system that's been installed in Japan?
No, we're not.
Uh-huh. Last question over here.
I just have a informational for Jeremy. Your concern about traceability, is it that every possible, you know, every interaction be traceable, or that certain classes of interaction be traceable? In other words, does it depend on the type of activity that's being undertaken? In other words, let's say I'm going to something like the New York Times, reading my stories. Does that need to be traceable?
Well, ultimately, that's a public policy issue. And so, I mean, the hypothetical was I'm giving the advice to the Attorney General. So in reality, I end up being the Deputy Attorney General, but that's fine. So I'm giving the advice, and my advice would be that if there are areas, if there are kinds of transactions, kinds of interactions where to do our law enforcement mission, we need to be able to get that traceability, then some of these technologies potentially could threaten that. And so it would be important to us to see that there would be the ability to have that traceability. Now, whether or not it's for all transactions, I doubt it. You certainly don't have the same level of need for traceability of your going and reading the New York Times versus your going and buying a plane ticket. But I think that you have to build in that, at least the concept of that scaling need for traceability, and I think that should be part of of the system, so that you can say, well, at what level do you need to have what kind of assurance back to a real-world identity in order to do a certain kind of transaction? And in a lot of cases, that will be something that will have to be negotiated between the two parties in the transaction. And in other cases, it'll be, the government will probably step in and require certain levels of assurance for certain kinds of transactions.
And I guess need is kind of a funny word at some point, because as this colloquy shows and the previous question about citizens just going about their business, when might you need, in the course of a very important investigation, to know who they are, it gets a little bit back to baselines. That's what I take this stable social norms question up here to mean. We have a certain baseline that I sensed in your presentation you were saying you'd like to replicate. That's why the diffusion of information needed for traceability is meant to kind of replicate the hassle that somebody might have to do right now, and maybe a hassle that isn't reflected in a law like Kalea, where as you move from analog to digital, you no longer needed to park with alligator clips in front of a house.
And partially, I guess it's assuming that there is a general recognition in society of the need or of the desire to get this kind of traceability, but only when absolutely needed. And so it should not be easy or desirable to have that traceability broadly and easily accessible. Yeah. So perhaps some of diffusion and anonymization and other kinds of technologies makes it so that that only when it's really necessary it's possible, but it's not easily grabbable to at any time without.
If there's a ticking bomb in a major city, when is it not necessary to basically get any information that could help you figure out who had that bomb?
When is it not necessary to...
In other words, it's hard for me to figure when you would say, if you could get to certain information that you thought might be a lead on where to find this bomb, that you would hesitate on privacy concerns. I'm only to say that necessary can be tricky.
It can be.
Yeah.
I mean, it certainly can be. And there's some acceptance of that concept in other areas that deal with privacy. For instance, in HIPAA, my understanding is that at any time, a doctor not only can, but is required to violate HIPAA when he thinks that it's necessary for the health of a patient.
Yes.
To share information when imminently it would cause harm or would not enable proper medical care to be given.
Yes.
So I think that concept does exist.
Yes, and in that sense, maybe a telco could come forward with information that happened over here or something. This seems a very opportune time to call on Stefan Brands. Tell us who you are, Stefan.
So, I've been working on identity and privacy issues professionally for 15 years now, very directly, both as an academic on the cryptology side and on the privacy side, having done a lot of privacy advocacy work and privacy advisory work for, amongst others, the Federal Privacy Commission of Canada. So if I've been to a lot of these kinds of conferences in all kinds of disciplines that relate directly to identity and privacy and security and anything related to that. And so if I sum up the past 15 years of experience, it's the only way I can sum it up is just with one extremely deep sigh. It's almost like a scream, deeply instinctive. In my good days, I think, you know, we have a chance of sorting this all out. In my bad days, I suffer from identity fatigue. I think I'm suffering from a digital bipolar disorder, maybe. It's the same issues for 15 years, and I'm sure for those who have been on the privacy side, maybe it's been like that for 30 years, ever since the advent of the computer, really, right? We're struggling with the same issues. What makes it so difficult for me is
just trying to summarize your talk as we go here.
Well, there you go. So the scream, yes. So there are a lot of well-meant efforts, and including by a lot of us in this room, and we all come from different disciplines. And my biggest worry is that in spite of a lot of well-meant efforts that they may drive us into a digital dictatorship even faster. One of the examples we cannot really cross multidisciplinary boundaries when we talk about this. It's very hard, right? We use different terminology. And even within our own boundaries, we fight and argue or disagree about little things about what is better and what's worse and how we shouldn't do things. Let's say I listen to the guy from IBM and I'm like, well, that's not anonymization technology. That's those salted hashes. I can invert those in microseconds on a computer if I have the salt, right? And both parties need the salt. So this is just sort of a way in which well-intended fair information practices are almost being misused to allow data sharing and matching in new ways that now claim to comply with those principles, which are defective in because they didn't anticipate the ways in which computers could bypass sort of privacy protections that hold in the physical world. So and in a way, right, this is contributing indirectly to accelerating the privacy problem, because if we don't get it right proactively, we're encouraging all kinds of ways that bypass our ineffective measures that we're taking with all the good intent. So sometimes I'm thinking that as a result of that because we're not building just a digital world here, right? I experience in all these forums and everything that's going on a lot. What I look at as digital Darwinism, right? It's all the power struggles that have been there since the dawn of humankind are now taking place in shaping the digital world. And as usual, things do not get sorted out in meeting rooms or by governments, but they get sorted out by people doing things that just take on. It's like it has to do with power play, with sheer coincidence and so forth. And so for building a digital world, that's fine. But that's to a certain degree. But in this case, when we talk about identity, digital identity, so we're talking about something much bigger, because we're really talking about extending the human being, the flesh and blood human being, into one that has extended capabilities by blending in computer technology first externally, but gradually this is going to be more internal, right? So the whole idea of cyborgs is not that far-fetched. So everything gets miniaturized, and you know, you look at the trends and the power of technology, and I'm just thinking what it takes for in terms of intellectual capability to address this digital identity problem in a way that avoids the rise of a really bad society-wide infrastructures that are going to stick with us for decades. We no single individual has that intellectual capability, and in fact, I think it transcends a whole generation. Anyway, those are my bad days.
Can I just make sure we understand your question, because I think that's an important question. Let me try to put it back at you and tell me if we've got it, okay? Mm. It's that it's actually not the scream that should be there. It's Mickey Mouse with the brooms. This is a Frankenstein monster story of you build something with the, well, best of intentions, maybe not Frankenstein monster, but you build something with the best of intentions, and everything looks like it'll go just fine, but it's such a powerful system that when the unexpected happens, and it can be diverted or reapplied or something, boom, we're suddenly in a very different space.
Right. In the electronic world, so there are no gray zones, right? In the physical world, there are. So there's like black and white and lots of shades of gray in terms of how things can fail. In the digital world, when everything is fully connected, there's really no in between. And so, I have a quote actually that I did want to read, which it's from a paper quite a while ago. It says the danger to democratic countries is not that they will openly embrace totalitarianism, it's that they will unwittingly, almost imperceptibly, and with the best of intentions, allow themselves to drift so far in that direction that the final step will then be but a small one. So that's certainly what I'm thinking about in my worst days, right?
I don't have the answer, but to
sort of think about what Kim said, that certain things are best left in the like sex and voting. In the meat space world, physical world, I'm wondering to what extent, you know, all this digital identity stuff, until we have experienced a lot with it, that maybe it holds for a lot of all this too, right?
Yes. No, in fact, it's reminiscent of the physics experiments where if you create just a little bit of antimatter, there's some de minimis worry that it might destroy the entire universe.
Right.
And it's like, you know, do we really want federal funding for that? Or should like...
So on my worst days, I look at those texts of Number of the Beast, and I'm not religious, actually, but I'm wondering what, you know, if there's some kind of...
All right, so I think we understand your question. Let's throw it out a bit, though. We'll come back to you.
I mean, what can we do? I have some pragmatic insights. In fact, I have prepared a sort of a 10-minute overview of how we could maybe update the Fair Information Principles.
So let's put that aside for a moment,
That's what I did. Yes.
And excellent. Thank you. This is a very, very provocative question. It's hard to imagine how the 10-minute other presentation could top it. But I'm intrigued for people out here to take this question on. Is this such a dangerous area that we should basically just go home? And is that, in fact, a viable option? So, yes, back here. Here comes the mic.
So I think we're too late. The horse is already out of the barn.
Tell us who you are.
Connor Cale from Intel.
Uh-huh.
The horse is already out of the barn. We already do a humongous amount of transactions online. Identity is part of those transactions. You can't close the barn now and say, let's wait 20 years until we figure out what identity would be, because you ain't going to learn about what identity should be until you're doing it and practicing it and understanding what it is in the real world.
But the horse has been out of the barn since the dawn of mankind. That's what we do when we interact. We share information, right? We want to get more information about others, so we just have new tools to do it. Now they get all digital. It's not a matter of are we doing this. It's a matter of how are we accelerating it to the point that we cannot control what we're creating, that maybe we should slow things down.
It seems now like there are two different horses out of two different barns. One is the horse that is bad policy, bad law, or indifference of powerful government agencies who are pursuing their own identity strategies. That seems like a very different bad horse from the one of should we just go home because the, you know, the powerful technology we're discussing here would you know, imperceptibly slip into authoritarian uses. And maybe we should discuss which is
Yeah, that's
which,
so.
Which is the more likely?
That's so interesting. I thought you were going to say the two horses. One was political abuse. The other would be technological surprise, a vulnerability you didn't expect in the system or something. Maybe there are three horses.
Political abuse or political, or just like disinterest. I mean, what if? Personally, I think the danger is not that the technology will be, you know, subtly misused. I think it's more likely to just not be. No one will pay attention to it.
Uh-huh.
They'll continue to be unenlightened.
Right here.
Well, I'm thinking that if I had my druthers and thought, well, gee, what kind of a system would I like to have, then that system would be functionally identical to the system that the Al-Qaeda child pornographer, money launderer would want. So I don't know if I'm going to be allowed to have that. So that's one way.
I perhaps missed one of the breakout sessions at which the system was described.
I think it's a great point. Some of the discussions over the last couple of days, I think, have been leaning a little bit in that direction, that people seem to have been talking about an ideal situation where they can completely do whatever they want and prevent other people from, whether it's corporate interests.
Go well below the baseline that existed pre these systems.
Exactly. That, you know, it prevents either corporate interests or governments from ever being able to tie together what it was that they were doing. And I think that's a dangerous idea, or not a dangerous idea. It would be a dangerous thing to have come into a place, because I think that the value that it would give to each one of us in terms of being able to manage our own privacy and deal with our own anonymity would not counterbalance the potential devastation and cataclysmic problems that would be allowed from allowing.
But now it sounds like you jumped on Stefan's bandwagon just in the opposite direction. I mean, Stefan is like, yeah, there's going to be a disaster. It might be, you know, the panopticon, or it might be that we're powerless because you have such total, terrible anonymity.
Well, now coming from the other side, I see that, and I'll just illustrate from the other side with a real example. I think there was very good systems in place for controlling criminal information data and preventing its misuse. There was also very strict systems for controlling income tax information and its misuse. And the great Richard Nixon, one of our great presidents, who was one of the advocates of good healthcare system, a guy who was in favor of all the world living together in peace and so on, nonetheless abused both those systems. All he had to do was snap his fingers and say, I know that's the law, but give me the information. I won't mention any other presidents that might have done the same kind of thing. I know Abraham Lincoln did it a little bit with habeas corpus, but he wasn't so bad. So I don't see how we can put any system in place that enables the, that prevents the Al-Qaeda child pornographer money launderer from doing what he wants to do. On the other side, I don't see how we can put any system in place that prevents the totalitarian system from being instituted.
No, this is now basically like the end of a Newsweek article, which always says, the future is uncertain, but one thing is clear. If things don't get better, they could certainly get a whole lot worse.
Yeah,
I do want to point out that my comments are not sort of targeted at near-term developments. I'm looking, it's more of where things are heading over the course of the next 3-4 decades, right? I mean, it may look like things develop slowly, but just a few decades ago, no one was using a computer or a phone or whatever. And so with the acceleration of technology, you add up all the trends. We could be sitting here two decades from now in a meeting room that's totally virtual, and our senses feel like we are all present here, but we sit behind a computer. I'm thinking identity.
Yes.
This is all part of identity, right? Like what a virtual model is doing, 3D representations, extending the senses. You can only do all these things through identity. They're going to be a big enabler, and they're going to create digital, morph us more into a digital world, and we're going to create dependencies as humans on how we interact as a result. So so all of these things, if you know, it's more the bigger picture. I'm not talking about near-term concrete use cases.
I hear it. I hear it. Kim Taipel has been waiting to get in for a while.
I think there's well, two things on the issue that we're talking about now. I mean, first of all, the concept that we can actually build technical systems that are so foolproof and 100% effective that they become this totalitarian system that can never have a resistance. I think even if we're orders of magnitudes, as Kim Cameron said, with security and everything, what we're trying to address is some particular problems now where the existing systems for managing identity are failing for a whole host of reasons. So we have a system that addresses those and looks pretty strong and pretty whatever, but you know it'll start to be broken on the margins. The second thing is that there are human beings that have to participate in these systems. To the extent that systems become oppressive again, you will have human resistance and you will start to break up things. For instance, I mean, all the identity systems that we've talked about now, particularly where you fragment identity, I will guarantee you there are people in this room thinking about this right now, and there will certainly be market developments of people who will think about, let me aggregate features among my peer group to screw up the system. So I'll put all of my book purchases with all of Jonathan's book purchases with somebody else in order to screw up the Amazon system to actually have a view about what I'm reading. And those things will start to happen on top of these systems. So, you know, I'm not sanguine about that we don't swing to a period where there are powerful systems that actually are oppressive. But I think that the history of, unless you're going down the technological route that actually destroys the universe, in which case I think we do have a problem. But short
of consensus on anything,
right? Short of destroying the entire universe, right. I'm not so sure that systems become so effective. You know, that we can actually build systems that are so effective that long term they actually can't be resisted.
Yeah. But the reach of these new identity systems is so enormous, right? They span boundaries by design. This is something new. And it touches our identities as humans. It's an extension. So what I'm saying is that the a reactive approach to dealing with bad systems may be extremely ineffective, because this is the whole fear of privacy advocates. We call it the slippery slope, right? We take steps in the wrong direction, and at every point we take the attitude of if it's not good, we try and correct it. People will resist it. But with this kind of technology. That's why I'm worried that you know, by moving too fast, that the consequences are totally out of control before we know it. And
well, I don't think that we can prevent certain kinds of technologies from existing. I do think that there are a lot of things that we can do to keep them from becoming woven into the fabric of our society. Not in all cases, but in many cases. So, for instance. I do believe that technologies will continue to come into existence that makes it easier for the Al-Qaeda child molesting money launderer to try to do what they do in utter secrecy. It makes it easier for them. But I also don't think that we necessarily need to adopt those kinds of technologies as the way that we buy books and as the way that we buy airplane tickets and so forth. So we have the ability to create other technologies that we choose to use for many of the things that tie into important transactions in our real world that have the aspects of the system that we want. And now for me, I mean, I see the aspects of the system that we would want in the ideal case to be there is a record of important things that I do. What exactly important means obviously is, you know, up to interpretation. There is a record of important things I do, but that record is only, that information about what I did is only available in very, very specific circumstances, and there are mechanisms built in that make it difficult for those processes to be broken.
Yes, yes. Basically mechanisms that can try as much as possible to maintain the status quo of the balance between accessibility and anonymity as we go. Let's bring in the final voice from our panel into this conversation. I'm especially mindful of the second most recently submitted question up there, pointing out that government isn't exactly different creatures, it's us, and is it possible to have a national dialogue on identity? And who better to help us address that question than Mary Rundle? Mary, tell us who you are.
Oh, I'm a fellow here at the Berkman Center, and also a non-resident fellow at Stanford Center for Internet and Society. And I've been doing a project that aims to shed light on net policy making at the international level and having a view toward bridging technologists and international policymakers in the name of promoting democratic mechanisms in the networked world. So I've kind of brought that with me to this conference. And what I've been listening to is a lot of talk about privacy and the idea that we need to protect privacy. And it seems that behind this is the idea that we need to keep power from being amassed and abused. And at the same time, we've also had a recognition that as society, we're changing our conceptions of privacy, whether it's in the need for security or teenagers feeling much more open about sharing information about themselves. So just to say that we're changing our conceptions of privacy as a society is not to say that we want to do away with the protections that allow political dissent or the protections against abuse. So I think instead what we've been implicitly talking about are complementary principles, both in terms of freedoms that are spelled out and in terms of structures. And I think it's these complementary principles that we need to focus on. So in terms of freedoms that the citizenry holds, I think it might be helpful if we thought in terms of a package of rights that work together. So in addition to privacy, for example, we need to safeguard freedom of belief, freedom of expression, and freedom of association. And it's these together that enable political discourse and help prevent abuse. Or in terms of structure, we might add that we need to build into the system separation of powers and checks and balances. Build it into the very structure, the architecture itself, so that power is not used to amass more power. By intentionally pitting entities' interests against each other, their roles against each other, the system can counterbalance power holders so that they can act as checks on each other, and they can prevent any one arm from exercising too much power or any one level of government from exercising too much power. And with that, I would add the principle of subsidiarity, the idea that decisions should be made at the most local level practicable, with the idea that decision makers are more in tune with people's interests and needs if they're close to them and listening to them. So that's what I would put forward as language and ideas that we should be using.
And I guess if we were answering a question with that, it would be what kind of framework could support development of new technologies. And by development, we mean non-paranoia-inducing development. But that's not going to fit. We need something like humanistic, how about that, development of new technologies. Does that sound
possibly
too fruity?
I think that could confuse people.
We wouldn't want that. Kim?
Value sensitive.
Right.
Which is actually a discipline.
Yeah.
There's and a certain circularity to value sensitive, because it depends on whose values we're talking about. That's the whole point, yes. 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 Also, though, in the B school world, as soon as it's on a slide, they think about value. They're thinking ROI, right? That's okay. We should be value sensitive that way, too. Other thoughts on this package? Yes. Bill McGivern.
Bill McGivern, fellow at the Berkman Center and privacy advocate of sorts. So Stefan and Mary have both pointed out ways to in different fashions sort of slow things down, I think, is kind of one of the lessons you can take away from their remarks, that by going too fast, we may slide into a situation where privacy is compromised. So a question to any of the panelists, but particularly you two, is the speed that you see happening now too fast? Because there certainly are people in the room who think it's too slow now, right? In other words, if things proceed at the pace that they are proceeding at now, are you comfortable or are you feeling like what we're seeing now is too fast to be secure about privacy?
I suppose what I'm talking about is taking ideas that are familiar to people who work with the law a lot or with civil society and political activism, taking those principles and bringing them to bear on technological development, or thinking of kind of a translation process there. And in that sense, I would say, yes, the pace of change is scary because it takes so long for policymakers to understand technology, and by the time they understand it, it's obsolete.
So we could start a petition here to repeal Moore's Law, right? Whoever passed that?
Huh. Or how about Godwin's Law?
Godwin's Law?
Yeah.
That's the one that at some point, if enough people are talking about something, someone will mention the Nazis.
Exactly. Yes. So it's kind of funny, though.
Did that just count?
For your question, I personally think as I'm also in business, there, of course, it goes way too slow for me. But the bigger thing is that the reason why I went into business is because I believe very, very strongly in the privacy aspects of it, and that's actually what I've been doing as an academic too. Everything I've been doing has been relating to that and been driven by that. And so, in many ways, I am happier that it is moving so slow. Yes.
And
well, it may also fizzle out. Eh? I mean, I've been part of the whole electronic cash or e-payments decade in the 90s, where everybody thought this is going to be huge, and the NSA was even looking at it and writing reports on anonymous electronic cash. And now today, no one is talking about it anymore, right? So, of course, what made it through was PayPal. That's sort of the digital Darwinism that I was referring to. So a decade of talking and people worrying about the implications, money laundering, child pornographers, privacy, and so forth, it simply never happened, and something just appeared that did something that people accepted.
But is there a lesson to be learned from PayPal? I mean, I understand PayPal to basically approximate Jeremy's status quo, that with PayPal, you're not completely anonymous. If you send money through it, and it was important enough to a decent government of the world, by decent I mean decently resourced, they could trace it back to you, right?
Yeah, there's no privacy, of course. Right. So the whole discussion of, as Mark Rodenberg has pointed out, maybe at the last Bergman workshop, that in the 90s, mid-90s, there was a strong awareness already at the start of the discussions around these kinds of systems of the importance of privacy and privacy by design. These days, we have to defend it. It's as if it's like the whole past decade, that's the deep sigh comes amongst artists from there. Mm-hmm. It's like it's just being lost. And people who were extremely active and vocal throughout that decade, they've all given up and moved to other science, right?
So is the world a better place for PayPal's existence?
I mean, PayPal addresses one particular use case. Digital identity, it may well go like that. One particular use case or a few, right? That's what people like. They'll address it. And that's that whatever system on the business side is smartest in seeing that business opportunity, that will appear. And it will grow organically from there. And no amount of talking we do in the room is going to change that. And privacy is going to be sacrificed unless we proactively bring in place some rules or guidelines. And this is primary responsibility of the government for me. The government is me, as someone said there, amongst others. And I'm frustrated with what I see happening, even well-meaning data protection commissioners approving things where I'm like, how is this possible?
So Ira, not speaking on behalf of all of non-government entities, but Ira and then Mary.
There seems to be a missing element to this analysis in the sense that we're saying slow down the development or the deployment of these more sophisticated, more privacy-friendly, next-generation digital identity technologies, but as opposed to doing what? Because what's the other element of these new technologies that make it more scary than allowing the current generation of technology, which was not designed to be privacy friendly and which relies on far less sophisticated cryptographic techniques, why is that less pr- problematic.
Well, we're sharing data across
such
domains.
That we need to slow down the new stuff.
We're sharing data and linking up identities across domains that used to be segmented, where these this sharing of data and aggregation never took place previously. So let's say electronic health record management, right? I'm not so sure that there's a lot of, there's billions invested in that in the U.S. and in Canada and in Europe, and there's so much effort there, and they haven't even figured out the basics and what the risks are to patients' privacy in the healthcare space.
But Stefan, let me try to rephrase Ira's question with Bill's question in it, okay? And that is, if you just take Moore's law, everything's getting bigger, faster, and louder. And you hold the architecture constant, you still have then growing privacy worries where it's a difference in degree can become a difference in kind. It's now possible for some cockamamie VA employee to take home on like a Mac store external hard drive everyone's data. Right, like so it's just on a single one touch.
I'm all for right. engineering holes in the wall. That means better protection for databases and things we do today. But digital identity, crossing identity silos, that's pretty much a new thing. The way we try to do it now, we're building digital pipelines that allow, like water, the data to flow from anywhere to anywhere potentially. This is something new. We're doing that today in ad hoc ways. And I'm worried about the implications of that infrastructure. I'm talking about infrastructure and society-wide, ultimately worldwide infrastructure for doing that.
Yeah.
That we should slow down. Yes.
So does that answer your question, Aaron?
But doesn't that mean we should speed up the deployment of the more sophisticated digital identity technology?
I think regulation is it's not about technology, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I think it's about both.
It's about both, right? But regulation is not catching up with it, right?
Yeah.
We're stuck with the fair information principles in the best, which are from the 80s. I mean, 1980 with a few modifications in various countries.
I mean, I hear you saying we're building faster cars, and I hear you saying, yes, but they have much better seatbelts.
Right, but I'm also saying, you know, the alternative is always the current situation, which isn't good.
Yeah. Mary, you've been wanting to say something.
I just wanted to go back to Bill's question and to say that even though the current pace of understanding among non-techies may not be high enough to deal with this current rollout of digital identity management tools, I think that this exercise that we're having right here as the identity gang and people coming in on board like that is we're learning each other's languages, and that's important. And I think that the technologists can learn the language of separation of powers and freedom of belief, freedom of expression, and so that later iterations of the technology can teach the machines to attribute different values to humans than to to objects. So, for example, okay, what's the difference between a human and a piece of luggage? They're both tracked through airports. Well, a machine could be taught to make those distinctions, I assume. I'm not a technologist, but I hope.
It just makes you wonder about babies being carried in sacks. Not that much, but a little bit. Our friend in the Northwest Quadrant.
Well, first of all, I don't want Mary to give the airlines the idea that they could treat me any worse, like the way they treat my luggage.
Talk
so
about the horse already out of
down.
The barn on that one.
Don't blog that. No blogging. Okay, I think, you know, I hate to interfere with the general sense of gloom, but because I'm gloomy too, you know, I'm profoundly gloomy. But I think that one of the most important issues that hasn't been discussed is the fact that, okay, what we're trying to do, a lot of us, you know, different implementations, we all agree on bringing the identity into the realm of the user's consciousness. Now they can see it. Now they can visualize it. Now they can understand they have one, not one, N, all right, because of the contextual thing. To me, the precondition, the only way to defend ourselves against privacy problems and, in fact, the technology future is for everybody to understand, you know, what's going on and what's in it. So the most important part of this technology is probably not the crypto or anything else, but turning the notion of identity into something that, you know, 5 years from now, everyone will understand. you know, there was a time when nobody understood what a file was. Nobody understood what a folder was, a directory. It was, those were like incredibly geeky things. Now, every single person, my son saw a file folder you know, in my office, and he said, "Dad, how did you get such a big one out of the computer?" You know,
are you putting him in the understanding category or the not understanding category?
He understands a folder. He understood it from the time he was a little boy because, you know, he was manipulating his files into the folder.
Right.
And I believe the same thing is going to happen around identity. Now, at that point, then the question of linking becomes a question. Right now, it's not a question because nobody understands. There's no way to get your arms around what it is.
And the optimistic note there is that this is essentially some headaches caused by transition. As new technologies come about and all of us are as unfamiliar with them as we might have been with file folders and directories, and that as we natively grow up with it and become acclimatized to it, we can master it rather than the other way around.
And it won't be experts mastering it for us.
Gotcha. Yeah, it is funny to imagine like a priest you'd go to get your identity exorcised or something, you know. Yes?
So I'm on the optimistic side. I'm Don Schmidt. Oh, and I have a microphone. I'm Don Schmidt from Microsoft. I am a colleague of Kim's. And I want to echo the optimistic side. I do have a question here for the panel. I have heard us come up to a point several times in the last couple of days. Stefan just said it. He said, part of the problem is in the past, this information was treated in segmented contexts or segmented areas. And now we have the process, we have the possibility of it being all in one big bucket so we can do collating or, you know, data mining, whatever. We seem to come up to that and then kind of wring our hands and go, whoa. And I'm going like, I don't understand why the question is why has this discussion seemed to be focused on one concern about privacy much more than the other? The one concern we seem to focus on is the possibility of tracking data, especially by the government. We seem to be ignoring a very other large thing about privacy, and that is data theft. That if someone gets, you know, someone can do personal damage to me, to my finances, or to my health, by getting information about me and then going and creating an account, simply opening an account, charging things, stuff like that. So many of the processes that we're worried about are actually supporting other huge benefits. I guess my question to the panel is, it's sort of like the gloom thing, why is there so much concern about the government privacy losses and not as much concern about the personal attacking privacy benefits that are just sides, different sides of the same coin?
I'm equally concerned about both. I mean, and those are not my only concerns, frankly. As far as I'm concerned, digital information about me is, in a sense, part of me. And the more is out there that can be tied directly to me as a unique individual, the more it means that I lose control and power over myself. I lose some of my autonomy in terms of decision power, and all the things you mentioned are just aspects of that. The fact that now someone else can steal that, misuse it against me, delete it, modify it in ways that work against me, control me. So those are just aspects of it.
But am I right in understanding your question to say many of the technologies we've talked about in the past day or two actually are specifically designed to solve the second of the two problems
Correct. That
you were talking about?
But you can build a totalitarian society in a way that concentrates all the power and all the knowledge about everyone in one Fort Knox that sits at the bottom of the ocean. Well, maybe some people would say that's fine with me, then I feel secure. But at that point, there's also the notion of that, is that a big brother? Is that sort of the ultimate?
So your answer is you can have a totalitarian society.
It's like let's say where technology trends are driving, let's say right, the whole identity, where we're only at the first percentage of this whole evolution in the next 4 or 5 decades. You can build these systems that I believe are foolproof against hackers and you name it, anyone who's deemed to be an insider with undesired powers. And so it's just you push it to a part where other parties say this is enough, that will never be attacked. We'll surround it, we'll protect it, and you're safe.
Okay,
right?
So I understand what you're saying. Let me clarify then. Drop the other shoe. My concern is that we seem to be focusing so much about information, and a number of the problems we're working on can be fixed by a very simple mechanism. Stop using public data like they're secrets. How do you get an account? You give them all these secrets, like your social security number, your mother's maiden name, you know, your mascot in high school, etc. These are not secrets. So there's lots of mechanisms whereby we reduce the value of data to harm us by just treating it like data.
So okay? Strong authentication.
I'm sorry. I'll get off my little soapbox. I'm new to this thing. I should be better behaved. But I feel like this is an actually very new environment to me. I'm a plumber. I build security and authorization systems. My eyes have been opened in the last 2 days to the fantastic opportunities of what's going on here. And I'm just like, I want to go home on a note thinking like there's some really good and positive things we can do, and there's probably some simple mechanisms that we can make a lot of progress on. That's all. I'm sorry.
No. Well, on that note, I would personally suggest maybe as a group we can sort of decide, or at the next conference, hammer out some topics that we all think are extremely important, and then agree on some questions that we may all want to address from our own disciplines and see if we can make progress. Right now, I feel this conference, it's been extremely important, and I'm very pleased that this has been put together. It's multidisciplinary, and so there's a lot of sort of awareness and people getting insight into how the other areas look at the same problem. So, but to have good progress, I think it would be good to now phrase topics of multidisciplinary interest and all contribute in constructive ways to it. That would be my suggestion.
So can I shift us on gears, given the time? I understand there's another day tomorrow for which it wouldn't be so terrible if we were to provide input into it, so it's kind of a running start. So I have just a slide here called Topics for Tomorrow, and understanding the limitations of my hearing and typing, in the spirit of a mashup, I would actually just be delighted to kind of solicit Quaker meeting style people to tell us a few topics for tomorrow, perhaps grounded in the discussion we just had. So,
John, you talked a lot about the new technology, but in the introduction to this panel, we talked about new legal frameworks. So if we could have the rest of the discussion about...
There is no rest of the discussion. There's a list of topics for tomorrow.
So
for
let's
which new
continue
legal
on
frameworks
to the new legal
qualify.
Frameworks component yes. of today's debate.
Other nominations? Yes. And by that, you mean like kind of a tutorial would be helpful on how crypto works, or you mean, uh-huh? Yep.
The intention economy.
But maybe the attention economy might be worth talking about, too. The intention economy. Okay. Yes, Andy Oram.
Alternatives to collecting identifiable data. I'm often impressed how you can achieve your goal without attaching identities to data.
Alternatives to, so it's not even there to be hashed or snowed later, it's, right. Yep. Other topics for tomorrow. Over here, way over here, yes. Such as the demo that'll be happening tonight.
Back up under cryptography, would you add a specific
topic? Sure.
Zero knowledge groups?
Proofs. Zero knowledge proofs. Like the kind most freshman calculus students do. Good times, those were. Yes? Say again? Electronic payment something models. ID models, of course. Anything else? Reputation. I think that's a fascinating subject. I endorse that. Anything else? Yes.
Identity as pi r.
Prior art.
Prior art.
High art, not as pi r. That goes back to Trig. So identity, like, that's identity as high art? Excellent. Any other desperate additions to this, or is this a good start to sort out from our group? So let me just say, I sense in our panel and in our gathering total enthusiasm for new gadgets and for exciting new things, and I want to be the first to line up and be handed a card. I know not why, but when I'm asked for my social and my birthday, you bet I'll give it to them, because it's going to enable something better than free small fries at McDonald's. So that kind of enthusiasm, juxtaposed with a true respect and love for the status quo and for as far as we've come and for the kinds of balances that have been struck and a way to try to maintain those while enjoying all the benefits that these new technologies can bring. And when I look forward 10, 20 years, if this one laptop per child thing pulls off and we have 100 million kids in a mesh network, I don't know if it's kind of the Home Alone munch scream or just a big smile about that. But listen, thank you all for such a great panel. Thank the panelists for doing it.